Our next case is Hoyle versus DTJ Enterprises Incorporated, case number 13-1405. Mr. Fitzgerald.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I am Tim Fitzgerald. I am here with my co-counsel, Michael Neltner, who is with me at counsel table, representing the Cincinnati Insurance Company. We are here this morning asking that the court reverse the Ninth District Court of Appeals and reinstate the trial court's decision granting summary judgment to Cincinnati Insurance Company on the issue of coverage. In April 2005, the General Assembly codified the standard for an employer intentional tort in revised code 2745.01. As with prior efforts to legislate in the area of employer intentional tort, the statute immediately became subject to attack on a number of constitutional grounds. Unlike the previous legislation in the area, however, revised code 2745.01 survived that constitutional attack. And in this court's decisions in Kaminsky and Stetter in March of 2010, the court upheld the constitutionality of the statute and made clear that it was the General Assembly's intent when enacting that statute that it was only permitted for an employee to recover in an employer intentional tort when it is established that the employer had the specific intent to cause injury to an employee. More recently, in the Hudak decision, this court again reiterated the fact that that was, in fact, the General Assembly's intent, that recovery in an employer intentional tort case today is limited to those circumstances where the employer specifically intended to cause harm.
Well, counsel, and I have written in dissents in a couple of those that there's nothing left but crime.
Very familiar with your dissent, Your Honor.
Nothing left but crime, and insurance companies don't cover policyholders for crimes that they commit. But there is that one exception, and that is the removal of safety devices, and that's what's in play here. And help us understand. It seems that it comes down to an argument then, in terms of your policy language, that all the provision about removal of safety devices does is give the injured party a leg up in the proof. That some burden is thrown on the employer if the safety device is removed to show that they did it for reasons other than to cause injury. And if they show that, then the injured party still has to show to the contrary, even with the removal of the safety device. They still have to prove, is that the argument, that it was intended to cause injury, and if they do that, then your policy language takes you out of coverage?
The burden on the employee never shifts in an employer intentional tort case, whether that is pursued under the subsection A provision of the statute or subsection C, where we have the rebuttable presumption. The rebuttable presumption never shifts the burden of persuasion away from the employee. They always, in every case, will have the burden to establish that it was the intent to injure that gives rise to the liability.
But the employee can rely on the rebuttable presumption in C. Can that claimant have that right?
What C does is it provides a means to establish that intent to injure.
It says if it's removed, there's a rebuttable presumption and injury results.
And we're not quibbling with that. This case is not about whether or not the employer can rebut it, what amount of evidence is needed to rebut it. It's the significance of the either unrebutted presumption or the presumption that prevails is that the end result, the final finding of liability against the employer is that they had the intent to cause the injury. It is no different under a direct proof under subsection A or under the rebuttable presumption under subsection C. The end result will be the jury verdict finding intent to injure. And with that finding, with that limitation on what is now permitted in the employer intentional tort area, is no difference. The burden is the same. There's no difference between the direct proof.
But you don't have that finding, or are you saying that the summary judgment gave it to you?
No, we don't need that finding, Your Honor, because what we're saying is that no matter what happens on remand between the employer and the employee in this case, if the employee prevails, it will be with the finding that there was the specific intent to cause him injury. If the employee doesn't prevail, then there's no issue in terms of indemnity anyway. And keep that in mind. What is in play here is the duty to indemnify. We're not talking about the duty to defend. So the definition of a duty to indemnify is there has to be liability found against the employer. And
if the employee prevails and shows it was deliberate injury and overcomes the presumption, there's no coverage. Deliberate intent.
There will be no coverage regardless, Your Honor, at least as far as the indemnity.
And otherwise, there'd be no liability because there wasn't a deliberate intent. So
correct.
Does that make your coverage illusory?
No, it does not. Because
What is it that your policy covers?
What is significant here, Your Honor, is when this policy went into effect. And the policy went into effect during that interim period of time between April of 2005, when the statute went into effect, and this court's decisions in Kaminsky and Stederer in March of 2010. And what the Cincinnati insurance policy endeavored to do at the request of its insureds was to provide some level of coverage that if this court's decisions in Kaminsky and Stederer had come out on the opposite side, in other words, found that the statute was unconstitutional, as had happened repeatedly in the previous legislation, that there would be no gap in coverage for that employer. And that was how it was designed. If you look at the definition of an intentional tort, or the intentional tort coverage that was provided by the Cincinnati policy, it mirrors the Fife standard, and that was done so that there would not be a gap in coverage if the statute ultimately was found to be unconstitutional. Now, we know it wasn't found unconstitutional, and so that exception to the coverage, the deliberate intent exception to the endorsement for employer liability coverage, kicks in. And we know that under the statute, if there is that deliberate intent to injure, there is no coverage.
So
if that were so, does that mean there were riders issued and there were refunds given to policyholders
for
premiums that were paid for this coverage?
The practice at Cincinnati Insurance Company after Kaminsky was to do away with this coverage, and if there was a gap between the time of the Kaminsky decision and the end of the coverage that had been purchased, yes, there was a refund that was offered to those insureds. So the employers would have gotten a refund after Kaminsky was decided in March of 2010.
And now the insurance contracts read differently?
Yes, they do.
By differently, you indicate there's just no coverage, period.
What Cincinnati Insurance provides today is a defense-only coverage. And in essence, that's what they are providing to Kavanaugh and DT. J is a defense that will continue on, regardless what the court does here, will continue on through the trial.
So they agree with me.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the end of your question.
They agree with me. There's nothing left.
There's nothing left for, I'm sorry.
In terms of intentional tort.
Well, obviously, if there is proof that an employer deliberately removed a safety guard or deliberately misrepresented a toxic or hazardous substance,
that wouldn't
there
be a
could
crime.
There could be coverage. Yeah. An employer that commits an assault or battery on an employee,
right.
You know, certainly there would be liability there.
But it would be, they're treating it just as if it's what's left is a crime.
Well, and that's, in essence, what the General Assembly has done, as this court has recognized in Kaminsky, Stederer, Hudak, Hewitt, it's without question, I think, at this point, and I understand your disagreement with that, Justice Pfeiffer, but it's...
So your view of C, which is really the open section that still needs clarification, I guess, your view of C is that it's not a way to reenact substantial certainty.
That is correct. It is not a different tort. It is not a watered-down intentional tort component. It is the same burden, the same standard that applies under subsection A. If you look at the statute, the language that appears in subsection A is identical to subsection C. In other words, intent to injure appears in both sections. And since it appears in the same statute, it is our position that that phraseology needs to be interpreted consistently throughout. And if it means something in subsection A, which this court has said it means in Kaminsky and Stetterer and Hudek, means the exact same thing in subsection C, that when that rebuttable presumption kicks in, if the employee prevails, that means that the employer is just as guilty, just as liable for that conduct as he would be under subsection A. And that's why the coverage, the endorsement exception applies here. There's also an issue in this case that I think even would be addressed by the court before we get to the endorsement exclusion. And that is the question of whether or not insurance coverage, indemnity coverage, is even available under a public policy argument. And this court in the Harrison decision back in 1990 recognized that when there is employer intentional tort that is based upon direct intent to injure, that the public policy in this state is that there will be no insurance coverage. And it is our position, Cincinnati Insurance Company's position in this case, that this new statute that makes liability triggered only when there is that direct or specific intent to injure falls within that Harrison directive, that there is no, the public policy of the state is that you don't want to give employers the incentive to engage in intentional wrongdoing. And it is our position that if there was coverage available under circumstances that now exist under the statute, that's what the effect would be encouraging or
And so a number of these cases that arose, the employer exposed employees to very hazardous things that they were going to inhale or be exposed to and didn't tell them what they knew about the dangers. I'm thinking of the Brush Wellman beryllium situation, in which a lot of people can take a bath in this stuff and not be harmed by it, and a few people get deadly illnesses from it. They knew that, the employees didn't know that. How does that fit in under the new statute, that kind of a situation?
Well, if there's the deliberate failure or misrepresentation of the toxic substance or hazardous substance, there's going to be liability. It seems to me that the public policy of this state should be telling employers, if you are going to engage in that type of activity, we will not permit you to shift that loss to an insurance company. And I think that's what Harrison says, is that when there's a direct intent, a specific intent to cause injury to an employee, the public policy of the state is to discourage that at all measures. And I can't think of a better way for this court to tell employers in this state that if you deliberately misrepresent a toxic substance or a hazardous substance, or you deliberately remove an equipment safety guard that causes injury, that you can't shift that loss to an insurance company any longer.
Isn't that what Judge Teodosio said in his entry?
He did not address the public policy argument, Justice O'Neill.
He said any possible surviving claim would necessarily include the intent to injure and would be precluded by the insurance policies.
What he was saying, I believe, in that provision of his opinion was that the policy's coverage mirrors the statute. In other words,
you can't insure against a bad act in Ohio.
Correct. I'm into my rebuttal time. If there's any other questions, I'll be more than happy, but I'll reserve the rest of my time for it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, by the way, as a matter of personal privilege, I had a coughing attack there, but I did not miss a word of your argument. This is a very electronic courtroom.
Glad to hear that, Your Honor.
Mr. Flowers.
Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Paul Flowers. I represent the plaintiff appellee in this case, Dwayne Hoyle. I'm going to be sharing my time with Mr. Bernlohr, 7.5 minutes each, if all goes well. David Grant is the attorney who handled this proceeding below for Plevin and Gallucci, and he can't be here today, but I'm sure he's here in spirit. I thought I'd start with the line of questioning that Justice O'Donnell was asking. Dealing with the effect that this presumption should have. I believe very firmly that this presumption that's in subsection C has a substantive impact. It means more than just that we're going to temporarily shift the burden of proof here for the time being, but the employee winds up exactly where he was before. It just doesn't make any sense that this provision would not only be included in this version, but also in the predecessor versions, just for such a purpose that really has no impact. And once that's understood that this is a substantive issue, that now the employee has this presumption that survives through to the jury proceedings and for the jury to decide, then it becomes clear that this really is an issue that can be covered by insurance legitimately. And it's just the same as a substantial certainty test. You don't have to prove that there was a deliberate intent to injure that employee. You still prevail just because there was a deliberate removal of a safety guard and the presumption wasn't rebutted. That can be covered by insurance. It doesn't violate public policy because we're not talking about deliberate acts. And that's what the Harrison versus Normandy Metals case said. And this court again said in Campbell versus Allstate. It doesn't generate those same sort of public policy concerns. So that's really our position here today, is that presumption needs to be given a substantive force. Yes, there are cases where summary judgment may be appropriate on the rebuttal evidence. The Redisel versus Ford Motor Company case is one that might be appropriate. But here we have a genuine issue of fact over both whether the presumption applies.
So what would be the evidence that the employer, Kavanaugh, could offer in this case? Which you'd be hoping he would offer, apparently.
Right. This case, you've got the usual, we didn't mean for him to be hurt. You know, sure, we were violating OSHA. Sure, the structure was bound to collapse, but we hoped he'd get through it, and we didn't really want him to be hurt.
So there were pins on a scaffolding that somehow were not there.
Right. It's a the scaffolding is permitted by OSHA if it's done right, so it's two ladders propped up against the wall with a board between them, jack scaffold. OSHA does allow that if it's done right, but you have to have all these security features, which they didn't have. They violate OSHA in a number of respects. But key for here is that there are these pins that had to be inserted into the ladder jacks to keep it from separating, the very thing that happened here. And the supervisor said, you don't need them, they're my office, you know, get the job done.
So your argument is that in our review of subsection C, there's a rebuttable presumption that the lack of a safety guard, if in fact the pins are safety guards, is evidence of deliberate intent to injure.
Correct.
And then Kavanaugh has the right to rebut that.
Absolutely.
And if Kavanaugh is successful, how do you see that outcome?
Well, that's up to the jury, and that's really the only two outcomes. You know, first they find, well, to back up a minute, the trial judge found that there's a jury issue over whether those pins qualify as equipment safety guards. So the plaintiff has to surmount that.
So there's a factual question on that.
Right, there. If they do, then the question becomes whether or not Kavanaugh rebutted the presumption, and that's for the jury. Plaintiffs win if they don't rebut it. Plaintiffs lose if they do rebut it. But in no case is there any proof here.
Are you then saying that this case is premature because we really don't know all the facts yet?
Yes, we've said that. These coverage disputes are impossible to decide until you actually have your verdict. I mean, we're kind of guessing here what's going to happen. But even looking at the range of scenarios, there's not going to be any proof in this case that DTJ Kavanaugh deliberately intended to injure this employee. I mean, the trial judge has already said there's no evidence on that and granted summary judgment in that part of the case. So there is nothing here that's going to be excluded under their intentional acts. All right. And really, all we have to show here is that there is a possibility of coverage, of a claim being covered, in order to prevail. You know, they've got to show there's no chance, which they can't do here. It's just too early to tell.
Well, their coverage is only for deliberate acts, though, is it not? So,
right.
So there wouldn't be any coverage if Kavanaugh prevailed. They wouldn't have any exposure.
Right.
I think that's Mr. Fitzgerald's argument.
Right, yeah, I'm sure as the employer's counsel is hoping, they'll prevail and we'll have no dispute here anymore. That's not going to be the problem. The issue is, you know, with the plaintiffs, how do we get there and have insurance coverage? And it seems apparent to me, since we're not going to have any proof of a deliberate intent to injure, there's nothing that's going to fall within that clause of theirs. You know, I mean, their clause has expected or intended from the standpoint of insured, you know. It really, the policy here is what drives this appeal. I mean, this case turns on this policy, a policy that no longer is in force and nobody's using anymore.
Aren't you in a catch-22 at this point, Mr. Flowers?
I hope not.
Well, me
that
too.
Sounds
but,
scary.
But if you prove at the trial court level that there was no intention to injure this employee by this employer,
right.
Now the insurance company is back in, right? But don't you lose on the tort?
No, because that's the purpose of subsection C. I mean, there is one remnant left there, in my view, that gives the injured worker a path to a recovery in these cases without proving a deliberate intent to injure. And that's through the deliberate removal of the safety guard or misrepresentation of a toxic or hazardous substance.
But counsel, isn't that a legal question? I guess I'm confused with the concept of having a question of fact that remains. Your questions of fact relate to the bolts, whether there were some actions by the employer, but we already know that there's no evidence of a deliberate intention. So aren't we left only with a legal question as to that issue?
Well, it begins as a legal question, but you've got disputes over those facts, I guess is the way I would put it. So here, the trial judge found, and this part of the order is not before this court, but he found that a factual dispute existed over whether those pins qualify as equipment safety guards. That's his first fact. And then the second factual dispute, which the trial court didn't get to, but the Court of Appeals did, is over whether or not the presumption has been rebutted. So yeah, it starts out as a legal question, but you've got these disputed facts that need to be resolved at trial.
It seems to me the legal question is whether C is procedural, as your opposing counsel wants to look at it, or substantive, as you want to look at it.
Correct. That's the one issue that really hasn't been decided that's right here before the court now. And it just doesn't make any sense that all this time and effort would go into putting in subsection C for it to be something ethereal, you know, that just exists for a moment and then is gone as soon as the employer says, we didn't mean to harm him. It's got to be more than that. So I've used my time. I would ask you to please affirm the Ninth District.
Mr. Bendler.
May it please the court, Your Honors. My name is Mark Bernlohr. I represent the employer in this case. I'm in the awkward position of cringing when he talks and cringing when he talks also, or being happy when each one of them talk. Obviously, we do not share in the interpretation of 2745 the way the plaintiff does. At the same time, we believe that given what the court has done, the trial court has done, that the trial court has left open an area that is something less than deliberate intent, which then triggers insurance. So we're in a situation of, by the appellate process, trying to remedy a situation which is, as I think the court pointed out, we're halfway there. It's our position that we're here for two reasons, and basically two errors. The first error being the fact that in 2005, when the statute was enacted, Cincinnati Insurance Company didn't change its policy. Here we have a 2007 insurance policy that was sold to my client, purchased by my client. My client paid $2,649, I believe, didn't receive a refund, and 2 years prior to that, the law changed. So we've got the old language under the old Fife standard being sold to my client in 2007, even though the law was enacted in 2005. So
that,
now they're trying
that
to
issue isn't before
you
us.
You did not receive a refund, you're no. saying?
Okay. No.
Well, that issue isn't before us, though, is it?
Well, the issue of, I'm dovetailing that into coverage. I mean, how can the Cincinnati Insurance Company say that you don't have coverage when their own policy refers to an old standard, and then they today are saying, well, we're waiting for your decision in HUDEC, and I think HUDEC, and so now that HUDEC has decided, we no longer have coverage.
How do you view the presumption in subsection C that the removal of a safety guard, in this case the pins, is a rebuttable presumption of deliberate intent to injure the employee?
The way I view that is if the trial court, as in this case, already determined that there's no deliberate intent, subsection C is neutered. I mean, there's no reason for it. You know, if I had my druthers, there shouldn't be any subsection C because the court has got to determine whether or not there's deliberate intent or not. In this case,
well, that's a finding for the fact finder, is it, or the court, or the jury?
Well, the court already granted summary judgment on that issue. The court determined that there's absolutely no evidence of any deliberate intent. We have a problem with the fact that the court then went on.
Well, if the court says no deliberate intent, what does it do with a finding of the removal of the pins, which the statute says is evidence of deliberate intent?
Your Honor, I think you end up at the same place, though. So the plaintiff gets a presumption that says, okay, Kavanaugh, you have to then say how there was how you countered that. And so we counter by saying, well, we had no deliberate intent to remove those pins. Incidentally, this is not even a negligence case, let alone an intentional tort case. The very man who was supposed to put up the ladders is the one who didn't secure them. And when you have two ladders going up here and one going across, and you stand at the very end of it, and you forget to secure this end of it, you're going to have a teeter-totter. And that's exactly what happened. But so I'm sorry, I got off the path. I think the question was, what's the presumption all about? What happens? If the court already determined that you can't get to deliberate intent, which it already has in A and B, there's no way C can then make you get into, somehow override that deliberate intent finding. And what the plaintiff wants to do is say, hey, we've got another way of getting to judgment around that deliberate intent. And we're saying no, you don't. Which, again, I'm going on both sides of that.
Well, now you're discussing the merits of the case rather than coverage. And I think with respect to coverage, your position is they gave you a policy that used the Fife standard. And if that's what the policy uses, the fact that legislation narrowed the exposure is to their benefit in that there are less factual patterns that could expose your client, but it doesn't take away the coverage for those things to which you are exposed.
Your Honor, I understand exactly what you're saying, and that is my position, except for what the trial court did. The trial court said, you know, even though you should have no coverage, and I'm putting words in the court's mouth, even though you should have no coverage because there's no deliberate intent, we're going to allow you to kind of go around it by using C. And my whole argument in the Court of Appeals was, hey, if the court's going to do that, then the court also has to say the coverage exists, because you can't have it both ways. You can't, I mean, the trial court in this case obviously said there's something less than deliberate intent to allow this case to proceed. If there's something less than deliberate intent that the plaintiff can prevail on, then following Harrison, we ought to be covered. If we had our choice, hey, once you find that there's no deliberate intent under A and B, you can't then curtail I know you might disagree, Your Honor, but there shouldn't be another way under C to get there.
What is the outcome you want us to write in this case?
I think this court has a decision to make whether they want to address, inclined to address the bigger picture of the intentional tort statute in 2745, or whether they just want to address coverage.
Well, isn't this case limited to the coverage, though? This
it is.
This is a Cincinnati
it
insurance
is, but,
company.
I know,
right?
But you, yeah, but I mean, you get kind of sucked into it.
We don't have the whole case here.
What's your position on the public policy? Should there be insurance for intentional torts?
Yes, if you are going to follow what Judge Teodosio did, and that's what Harrison says. If there's going to be a subset of deliberate intent, and you're going to, you know, that's 1990, Harrison. If you're going to allow something less than deliberate intent, then we're going from punishing the employer, which there should be no coverage for, and my guy takes a beating.
Let's assume that we say deliberate intent. Intentional tort means deliberate intent. What's your position then?
Then the public policy, there should not be coverage.
Okay. And it's just the idea that if there's something less than that deliberate intent, there should be insurance coverage for that.
Then the override, yes, the overriding factor should be victim of the compensation mm-hmm. versus punishment to the employer.
And that's what your client thought they were purchasing.
Yeah.
They thought that based on the language that was presented to them and the policy that was sold to them in 2005, did you say?
2007.
And this accident happened?
2008.
And even though there's an argument that that policy language was unnecessary pursuant to law, you still bought it and paid for it.
Yeah. It was our intentional.
They offered it to you. You paid for it, correct?
It's a rider to our general liability policy. It's a rider marketed as, here's your intentional tort coverage. Here's a rider. Here you can see, read there, it says, we will cover intentional acts.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a difference between intentional acts and intentional torts, or intentional acts that are meant to harm or substantially certain to harm, correct?
Right. But that rider even addressed that. It says we'll cover intentional acts,
right, but not
deliberate intent to injure.
Exactly. So they pretty much said that unless you're going to commit a crime, you're covered, and you paid a premium for that, and you say that there was no refund.
Your Honor, I don't believe there was. I honestly may be wrong about that, but I don't believe there was. I believe my client would have sent it back saying, what is this all about?
So what are you seeking us to do?
To find that there is coverage. If, in fact, we're going to follow the trial court's decision, erroneous decision, and I know that's an awkward position. I don't even know if it can be done.
Well, if we were to reverse the judgment below and find that deliberate intent is deliberate intent and intentional tort is deliberate intent, then there's no liability for the employer in this case, correct?
That's right.
And you received the coverage for your defense under the policy, correct?
That's right. And we would go back to the trial court and file our motion for summary or ask to reconsider the prior, saying, once again, we've got HUDEC, we've got this, we've got that. And for the final time, you can't, 2745, you don't get two cracks at it. It's either deliberate intent or not. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel, you've saved 35 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two quick points. First of all, this is an issue of law, not an issue of fact. It doesn't matter what happens on remand. In fact, the assumption here is that the employer is going to lose. We're not suggesting that should be the outcome, but for purposes of indemnity coverage, you have to assume that there's going to be some liability found, and the question is, what does that mean? And it's our position that the only way there can be liability found against Kavanaugh is that they deliberately and specifically intended to cause injury to Mr.
But you're saying that has not been determined, because opposing counsel is saying that it's been summaried out.
They have been found on summary judgment not to be liable under subsection A. The court has allowed the rebuttable presumption under C to continue. Our position is that if that case goes to trial, which it seems to be, and Mr. Hoyle prevails, he will have established the intent to injure that is precluded under the policy.
Why can't he just establish the intent not to put the pins in for whatever reason, convenience, inconvenience, sloppiness, whatever, and not go over the hurdle that Hoyle, I want to see you injured.
Because that's the only way he can prevail, is to establish intent to injure. That's exactly what the rebuttable presumption establishes, intent to injure. If you, that's exactly what the statute says. If there is a deliberate removal of an equipment safety guard.
Well, isn't that one of the first hurdles, too, is whether or not it, those pins were safety guards?
Absolutely, and we're not talking about that. We're assuming, Cincinnati is assuming for purposes, as they do in any declaratory judgment action involving insurance coverage, the assumption is, for purposes of an indemnity, that there is going to be a finding of liability. Our position is, what does that mean?
Those were not safety guards?
I'm sorry?
If they find pins were not safety equipment, what happens then?
Then the presumption never arises, and the case is over. Kavanaugh wins, and there's no indemnity.
Okay.
If they lose, there's no indemnity because they will have had to have been found to have intentionally injured Mr. Hoyle. Finally, in terms of the scope of coverage, I would direct the court's attention to the notice that was provided with this policy that is provided in the supplement at page 40, which clearly delineates exactly what was being provided here. And it goes into the very dilemma that we're talking about, which is there's uncertainty about whether or not this statute is going to be constitutional. If it is constitutional, then the policy clearly says there is no coverage. If the statute is found to be unconstitutional, then the common law standard will return and there is coverage. What's been provided here.
Is there any statutory definition of what is a safety guard?
No. No, this court in Hewitt, and in fact, in the case of Pixley, which is before the court now, will be addressing those issues, but we're not asking the court to actually parse that definition in this case. We don't need to, because again, the assumption is that Kavanaugh will be found liable. The only question is, what does that mean? And it's our position that under subsection C, that means the employer intended to cause Mr. Hoyle injury, and that's what's excluded from coverage. And that is the reason why summary judgment should be reinstated. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decisions. Marshall, will you call a recess, please?